The Takeaway is supported by the Netflix original documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Following a high-stakes legal battle over a celebrity sex tape, this documentary explores the shadowed world of billionaires undermining democracy, now streaming only on Netflix.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 27th, 2017.
First rule of medicine is do no harm.
I'd encourage all 100 senators to participate because the American people need better care right now. And this legislation includes the necessary tools to provide it.
I don't have enough data in terms of the impact to my state.
I'm concerned that we're going to keep most of the Obamacare subsidies. That to me just doesn't sound like repeal.
I don't have the feedback from constituencies who will not have enough time to review the Senate bill. We should not be voting on this next week.
You'd like to have questions answered before you proceed.
Unless we act, we can expect things to get worse.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening and call this hour. The philosophy of healthcare and the mystery over all those numbers. The GOP Senate bill is now having to live in the world of real evaluation. The numbers seem to say this: 22 million people, $321 billion, all in a 10-year timeline. The Congressional Budget Office released its findings on the Senate's Better Care Reconciliation Act. That's the title. Monday afternoon, we got the numbers. They say that 22 million Americans would be without coverage by 2026. The $321 billion refers to the amount by which it would reduce the federal spending, the federal deficit, or the federal budget, however you want to put it, by 2026. Political reality will change all those numbers here if the GOP initiative actually survives the pushback from conservatives. Senators like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, for instance, claim the Senate bill doesn't go far enough to repeal Obamacare. And moderates are raising concerns about the number of potentially uninsured after this bill is passed. But Ovik Roy, conservative healthcare analyst, argues for people to quiet down and let what he says are market forces and a different set of incentives than Obamacare connect with consumers. He says that in the slow-moving business of getting people to respond to healthcare policy, getting them to buy expensive insurance and worrying about their legitimate fears, Mr. Roy, who is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, says this is a moment to pass something and just let it work.
I'd make the argument that for 7 decades, effectively, the federal government has prohibited markets from working in the healthcare system. And that's not to say that we should go to some libertarian utopia in which there's no role for government at all. That's not what I'm saying. But that in very important ways, what federal policy has done, and Obamacare has made this a lot worse, is priced young and healthy people out of the market. So the reason why there's an individual mandate in Obamacare is because what the law does is it doubles or triples the cost of buying health insurance for young and healthy people. And so, of course, if you're going to charge a young person who goes to the doctor once a year and is perfectly healthy $300 a month for health insurance, when their average consumption of health care by a 20-year-old is about $700 a year, well, of course, they're going to look at that and say, you know what, that's a lot more money than I expect to spend on healthcare. So what you have to do is, through a combination of making the insurance market work for those individuals and a little bit more financial assistance, give them the incentive to join up in the pool. The mandate doesn't work. The mandate is not driving as much coverage as the CBO thinks it is. If you ask insurance companies, they'll tell you. The CBO says that of the 11 million people who are signed up on the Obamacare exchanges, 6 or 7 million of them are only signing up because of the mandate. No insurer believes that that's the case. It's more like maybe 10 to 15% of enrollees are signing up for the mandate. The vast majority are signing up because they want health insurance. And so there are ways to make the market work better for younger and healthier people who also want insurance, and while still protecting the vulnerable and the poor and the sick.
Although conservative and liberal observers of this have described the entire debate on healthcare as a huge social experiment to figure out what, in fact, young people will do. I mean, and in fact, you could say they may do this or they may do that, but in fact, we have some empirical data. The mandate is effective only so far. The GOP even recognizes that you need something more than market incentives to compel young people. I mean, there are amendments in the GOP bill that try to penalize the young people towards actually thinking about health insurance. I think you're right. If everybody thought in a progressive preventive way about having health insurance, we'd be in a much different world. But that's not the world that we live in. And the CBO is right. The initial response to this GOP bill is going to be a huge retraction back to a lot of people uninsured. And the federal government is going to pick up the cost of that.
Well, if the Senate passes this bill, obviously we'll be able to have this conversation, John, in 5 years and see who's right. But I followed this stuff pretty closely for a while, and that's my view. My view is that the CBO is getting it wrong, and that in 5 years, it's much more likely that more people will have health insurance than do today because of this bill.
And I think that's, you know, it would be great if that was the way we could do things in the United States. But in fact, I mean, there are people with disabilities who are worried about the Medicaid expansion, you know, elimination and changes in the open-ended.
Because the Medicaid expansion doesn't affect people with disabilities. People with disabilities are already eligible for Medicaid and Medicare
But there are caps.
This bill doesn't affect them.
There are suddenly caps on Medicaid. There are suddenly state options to withdraw coverage for certain disabilities. And
I'm glad you brought that up, John, because the so-called cap on Medicaid, which, by the way, is an idea that came from Bill Clinton in 1995, the measure of inflation that the Republican bill ties Medicaid funding to is 1% above medical inflation, which is much higher than the per enrollee growth in Medicaid spending on the disabled. So this bill will not cut spending on the disabled at all. And that's just one of the ways in which the coverage of this bill has been faulty.
All right. So you mean coverage? So people with disabilities who
coverage,
are afraid
the
of
media coverage of this bill.
All right,
been
but
faulty.
people who have been on Medicaid for 15 years don't read the paper to figure out what's happening next. They talk to their Medicaid worker. They talk to people who are affiliated with their healthcare provider. They don't watch CNN
sure,
to
how
find out.
Sure, how do those
out.
People get their information? They read that, the paper, right? So the information is getting to them somehow, and all I'm saying is that while it's understandable that people have fears because there's been a lot of fear spread through the way we collect information, they don't have anything to fear in substance because this bill does not do anything to take away their coverage or their options.
All right, so if the CBO is correct, how long do you think it would take for the incentives that you believe are in the Senate bill to bring us back to a situation where we have universal coverage or close to what the Obamacare numbers were? And the principle here in your white paper is universal coverage. How quickly will we get to that under this bill or something like it?
Well, the way the bill works is it takes about 3 years for the transition to take place from current law to the new system that the bill contemplates, because you need to give insurers in particular time to write the insurance plans that would reflect the new rules that this bill would install. So the thrust or meat of the bill really gets going in 2020 and 2021. And starting in those years, you'd start to see the transition to this new system of tax credits, and it's particularly the transition from those who get coverage through the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act into this new system where they buy their own health private insurance through the tax credit system, the same way that people on the Obamacare exchanges do today.
So if I've just been diagnosed with breast cancer or lung cancer, I'm fine for the next 2 years, and then I really do have to worry about the costs, my own pocket costs.
Well, you'd have your premiums would be covered, and depending on your situation, this bill does not cover the deductibles for people who are – it doesn't subsidize the deductibles to the same degree that the Affordable Care Act does. It does have about $100 billion in state innovation grants that states can use to fund deductibles. I have an op-ed in the New York Times today where I say that that's the most important thing in the bill to improve, that the Senate should contemplate increasing the amount of assistance – that it provides low-income folks to afford their deductibles.
Right.
That's probably the main thing to improve about the bill.
We've been talking for a good period of time here, and finally we get to the issue of, you're right, that under this bill, you know, in 2020 or 2022, people who are diagnosed with chronic conditions or fatal conditions like cancer are going to have a huge sticker price to pay for their coverage. And that's just something that the Republican bill says, well, you know, we'll just have to work it out. And it not only is it legitimate for people to be terrified, I mean...
Right, so let's well, again, this is how fear gets spread when you make blanket statements like that. So let's be very precise. What the Affordable Care Act does is the Affordable Care Act provides cost-sharing subsidies for people to buy to pay for their deductibles if their income is below 250% of the federal poverty level. Above that level, it contains no assistance for people to fund their deductibles. And for a lot of those individuals whose incomes are, say, $28,000, $30,000 a year, their deductibles have skyrocketed under this bill. So they have breast cancer, and they're paying a lot more for their premiums and a lot more out of pocket under Obamacare than they did before. So that's a problem that this bill addresses. And there also are, as I said, funds to cover deductibles, but that's an area for improvement. So that's one thing I think they should, before they pass this bill, if they do, revisit, in my view.
But what we come down to is the argument for people who are afraid of precisely these sticker shock issues is this bill can be improved. That's your argument. This is an improvable bill. That's what you got for them.
When Obamacare was passed, I think there were plenty of intellectually honest advocates of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 who believed that that bill was not perfect and could be improved. For example, a common criticism from the center left of Obamacare was that it didn't do enough, or some people would argue anything, to reduce the underlying cost of healthcare in this country. And that was a big concern of a lot of people who signed on. There were a lot of people who also on the left who didn't like Obamacare because, of course, it wasn't single payer. It used subsidies, tax credits for private insurance. And there were some people on the left who were hostile to that. But there's always things about any piece of healthcare legislation, particularly because of the politics of it, that are going to be imperfect. In my view, there are two things that I would improve, you know, in particular about this bill. One is what we've just talked about. And the other is I believe that we need to reform the way employer-sponsored health insurance works so that people there can have lower-cost health care as well. So, look, this bill doesn't do everything I would want it to do, but does it do important things to make the broader system and the system for lower-income people better? I believe it does.
Ovik Roy is a conservative health analyst and president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Ovik, thanks so much.
John, it was a pleasure.
Last night, even some senior members of the U.S. government were surprised by an abrupt warning from the White House about a possible chemical warfare attack from Syria, specifically referencing the attack carried out in April that the U.S. responded to with a cruise missile attack. Sean Spicer issued a statement saying Syria would pay a heavy price for another attack and noted that the U.S. has identified potential preparations for an attack. The Trump administration wants the Syrian regime and ISIS fighters to pay the heaviest price for prolonging the Syrian war, but in fact, civilians may be suffering the most. Between May 23rd and June 23rd, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights counted 472 civilian deaths in Syria caused by U.S.-led coalition strikes. That's more than double the organization's previous 30-day toll. Is this all a consequence of the Trump administration's strategy in Syria? Here's Secretary of Defense James Mattis on Face the Nation last month.
Our strategy right now is to accelerate the campaign against ISIS. We have already shifted from attrition tactics where we shove them from one position to another in Iraq and Syria to annihilation tactics where we surround them.
A United Nations war crimes investigator said that the U.S. campaign to reclaim Raqqa in Syria has produced a, quote, staggering loss of civilian life. Murtaza Hussein is a journalist at The Intercept.
The majority of this jump is likely attributable to an escalation in the campaign against ISIS as that campaign moves into major cities in Iraq, Mosul, and in Syria, Raqqa. In some sense, it was expected that there would be an increase in casualties because of the nature of urban fighting. But in addition to that, it seems, and many have noted this, that there has been a loosening of targeting standards around these airstrikes since the new administration came into office. And as you know, the administration made no secret of its plans to significantly alter U.S. military operations, which is a nice way of saying as Trump said, we're going to start targeting the families of people. We're going to start bombing the hell out of them, quote unquote. And, you know, it was easy to dismiss this maybe during the election as sort of bluster, but we're seeing, in the words of the UN, staggering death tolls in Iraq and Syria because of U.S. strikes in the past few months.
And as far as tactics are concerned, we're still talking about air. You know, this is an air war that is being conducted by U.S. planes. What kinds? Are we talking about A-10s? Are we talking about high-altitude fighters?
Bombers, drones, everything that the U.S. has available for this. And it's not a handful of strikes. There have been, since the U.S. started bombing Syria in 2014, there have been about 9,000 strikes. And we've seen an increase in the last few months. And the U.S. is in the sky, but they're also arming certain groups on the ground to fight and providing them artillery support in the form of direct U.S. assistance. The U.S. soldiers are firing that artillery in Syria. They're on the ground. So this is really an American war in many ways, in the sense that the weapons are mostly American, the air support is American, and the artillery support is American.
And so the expectation is more civilian casualties. Who and how will U.S. and, I gather, Russian forces that are also in the air be held accountable?
You know, it's very sad because Syrian lives have become very devalued in the last couple of years because of these atrocities, primarily by the Syrian government. There's very little recourse for people, especially in small towns or, you know, poor areas of the country who often bear the brunt of airstrikes. It's very difficult for them to even have their stories told or have them paid attention to by Western media. But the U.S. is a very ephemeral presence in Syria today. They're mainly in the air and mainly operating through proxies. So when there are cases of civilian casualties, it's very hard to even definitively say who carried out the airstrike, because even though we know that more than 90% of coalition strikes are carried out by the U.S. recently changed rules to ensure that the specific country responsible is not noted. So if you are a Syrian who lost a family member in an airstrike, you no longer are able to find out legally which country actually carried out the strike in the coalition, which is harder to get some responsibility for that.
Murtaza Hussain is a journalist at The Intercept. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This country's lack of a coherent policy on immigration means that people who spend their lives in the U.S. can still run into deportation problems. Non-citizens who volunteer for the U.S. military, for instance, thinking it will help them get citizenship, can find out quickly after their service that the medals they may have earned don't protect them from deportation. Getting in trouble with the law can mean facing deportation, and having been in uniform is suddenly no argument for citizenship. If you want to hear war stories, U.S. war stories, in Spanish, go to Tijuana, Mexico. It's become a haven for waiting veterans, waiting for their VA benefits, waiting for a chance to return to family. Stories of two different kinds of wars. Dorian Marina is a reporter for station KPCC in Los Angeles and is a contributor to the American Homefront Project. His series on veteran deportations today takes us to Tijuana.
Signs of American military life are everywhere in this cramped Tijuana apartment. A U.S. flag hangs on the wall. Army patches cover a camouflaged backpack. Former paratrooper Hector Barajas has turned his home into a shelter for veterans deported back to Mexico.
So I sleep here as well. This is my bunk.
There are three more cots upstairs and a tiny kitchen Barajas refers to as a chow hall. Together, the vets call this place the bunker. Tijuana attracts the vets for its proximity to the U.S. Many left Mexico as children, and many still have families on the other side. It's hard at first, says Barajas, who was last deported in 2010.
So it was very difficult to transition the first couple months, and that's part of our job here is to make it easier for the men to find work, which we're doing as well, helping them find their IDs, where to go get their driver's license. But it was difficult when you don't really have anybody to help you out with that.
The VA says it doesn't count how many vets have been deported, and ICE, which handles deportations, doesn't track which deportees have military backgrounds. But Barajas has a database of about 350 deported veterans, and he estimates there are a lot more. Barajas himself served two stints in the Army, including in the 82nd Airborne. But when he got out, he ran into trouble with the law. In 2002, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison for discharging a firearm from a vehicle. After prison, he was deported, but then re-entered the U.S. illegally and was deported again in 2010.
I paid dearly for it, and I am taking responsibility for putting myself in that position. And as far as being a productive member of society, you know, let's move forward.
Since then, he stayed out of trouble. In March, California Governor Jerry Brown pardoned Barajas and two other vets, noting their honorable service in the military. Barajas is hoping to get his legal status back and return to the U.S. For now, he spends his time helping other deported vets. Jesus Juarez shuffles with a cane into the shelter from the busy street outside. He pulls up his jean cuffs to reveal huge scars around his knees. He's 61.
Blew up both knees. I have all my medical records. It's all on there, you know.
Juarez says a doctor in Tijuana told him he needs prosthetics, but he can't afford them. There are no VA doctors in Tijuana, so he and other vets can't access their health benefits.
Look at that surgery. There. They're all cut up, both of them, huh?
His injuries came in a training accident while he was in the Marines in the 1970s that also left him with memory loss. Then his father suddenly died. He left the military with an other than honorable discharge. He was deported after being convicted in 1997 for drug possession in San Diego. That followed other problems with the law, including an attempted robbery conviction a decade earlier. He says since those days, he's cleaned up and hopes to one day return to the U.S.
If we were willing to give our lives for the country, I think we should be able to live there. You know, that's my place, you know.
Some deported veterans could get help from legislation in California that would set up a legal aid fund for them. Meanwhile, in Congress, Democrat Joaquin Castro of Texas says he plans to introduce a measure to help service members get their citizenship and prevent deportations for veterans who run afoul of the law.
If there is punishment to be had for a crime that was committed, that punishment should be meted out in a U.S. jail or a U.S. prison. But the person should be in the United States.
Back in Tijuana, Hector Barajas hopes to soon rejoin his family, including his 11-year-old daughter in Southern California. But hanging by the cot where he sleeps are metal tags reminding him that time is running out for other vets.
These are dog tags of some of the men that have died due to lack of medical health care. Six tags, but there's 10 people that have actually died. And up there we have one of the brothers who had died of pulmonary fibrosis.
Barajas says deported veterans face a harsh reality, barred from the U.S. while alive. They're eligible to return when they die, to be buried with other veterans on American soil. In Tijuana, I'm Dorian Marina.
Dorian Marina is a reporter for station KPCC in Los Angeles and is a contributor to the American Homefront Project.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting the original documentary Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. When a celebrity sex tape is leaked, a high-stakes legal battle between Gawker and former professional wrestler Hulk Hogan leads to the gossip site's ruin. Nobody Speak explores the shadowed world of billionaires manipulating free speech, ultimately revealing what power and money can do in undermining democracy. Now streaming only on Netflix.
Is it his style that's on trial or his philosophy for enforcing security at the border in Maricopa County, Arizona? Sheriff Joe Arpaio's trial in Phoenix is the biggest show in town. Arpaio's tough tent city jail approach for border crossers and immigrant criminals where temperatures would shoot over 100 degrees regularly, or his traffic patrols to seek out undocumented immigrants made him famous. But a judge ruled in 2011 that his patrols constituted racial profiling. He was ordered to stop them. He defied the order, and he's back in court, facing contempt of court charges. Jimmy Jenkins is senior field correspondent for KJZZ. He says the defense is trying to play Arpaio's popularity up, a real risk in this courtroom.
This is actually a bench trial, so Judge Susan Bolton gave them the option at the outset that this could be a jury trial, but that could lead to more potential time for the sheriff. So I think both parties were happy that it's a bench trial, which means that the maximum possible outcome would be a six-month sentence. She has been very skeptical of both sides, so it's kind of hard to get a read on which way the judge is going at this point. But I will say there does seem to be a lot of evidence presented so far that is going to make it hard for the defense to show that the sheriff was not aware of these orders that he's accused of violating.
Is this a case about Arpaio's style and toughness, or is it really a battle of philosophies on how to deal with immigration in a place like Maricopa County?
Ooh, that's a good question, and we're kind of hearing about that in court right now. I think the government would say that this is very much everything about Joe Arpaio and his policies, just his tendency to, throughout his whole career, kind of push back against the federal government, flaunt those that would try to come after him and hold him accountable for things like, civil rights violations. But then the defense would say that, no, the sheriff was actually acting in good faith, trying to enforce federal laws. But that's the thing here. He's actually gotten too carried away enforcing federal laws. At one point, his deputies had what's called 287G authority. So they were trained by the feds, and then they were allowed to enforce federal immigration law. But that authority was taken away. But the sheriff continued and expanded the program. And so that what we're looking at in court is how he went about doing that. And was he doing what a federal judge was telling him to do as things moved along?
What's the likelihood that Arpaio will, in a sense, kind of make himself a martyr and stipulate that, hey, I was just trying to protect the people of Maricopa County, all of this procedural stuff be damned, but that's going to be how they get him?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's likely. Like yesterday, most of the defense's opening arguments were just restating things that the sheriff had said publicly. They talked about how he, bragged that he doesn't serve a president or a governor. He just serves the people of Maricopa County. They kept putting up on the screen these news releases that those of us here in newsrooms in Phoenix used to see all the time, once a day, sometimes twice a day. They were often just bragging about how the sheriff, he won't back down. The message was that the sheriff does what he wants. He always jokes about how his favorite Frank Sinatra song is My Way, so it's not like he would ever play this down. But what they're arguing is that he was still doing things within the bounds of the law. And that's definitely the case they're going to make, that he was looking out for the safety of his citizens here.
Will the Department of Justice testify, even possibly the Attorney General?
Well, we learned yesterday that Jeff Sessions has been served a subpoena. And so the judge asked both parties if they'd heard anything back from that, and they said that they had not. So it's yet to be seen what the response will be from the Department of Justice.
Jimmy Jenkins is senior field correspondent for KJZZ and has been following the case in Maricopa County against Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Jimmy, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
In the horrors of the war in Syria, the practical matter of escaping violence means you bundle up your traditions and go somewhere else if you can. Possibly somewhere where your traditions are foreign, where they're suspect, where they're welcomed, but only as a minority. More than 4.5 million people have fled Syria, with around 18,000 settling here in the United States since the civil war began in 2011. One of them is a young teen, Dalia Zeno. Her past in Syria and her family's new lives in the United States are the focus of the documentary Dalia's Other Country, which airs this week on PBS as part of a series of films from POV. Julia Meltzer is director of Dalia's Other Country, and Dalia's older brother, Mustafa Rani Zeno, is co-producer of the film. Julia says this film is about a young girl's struggle to find an identity in a new home.
Dalia's Other Country tells the story of, well, primarily of a young woman who comes to Los Angeles from Aleppo, and what her experiences are and what her perspective is on that very dramatic change.
And when people leave a place like Syria, and when a young Muslim girl who embodies not only her physical life, but the philosophical traditions handed down by her family and her dad, who she says is her best friend, is really challenged in Los Angeles to try to maintain those traditions in Los Angeles. How does she do you think?
I think she does really well. I mean, she's an incredibly adaptable person. She's the only Muslim student at an all-girls Catholic school. And I think my thought at the beginning in making the film was that there was going to be conflict there, or that might be difficult for her. But it turns out the difficulties were more just about adjusting to a different structure in her family and figuring out who she is here without her father.
How much does she feel that the responsibility to uphold this Muslim tradition in this Catholic school is her command, and how much of it is a duty that she wished that maybe she didn't have to do. She mentions in the beginning that she had wished it was not an all-girls Catholic school that she was sent to.
It's probably a combination of these things. I mean, I think the same goes for the hijab for her. I think partially it's something that she feels like it is her duty. You see the scene with the with my mom, when mm-hmm. my mom wants to cover it up and she doesn't. And so I think at some level she feels like this is my duty to show that as a Muslim woman, I am a good representative of what that means. But I think also, like many people who end up having to be representative of people beyond just themselves, I think at some point in her life, she's definitely been maybe resentful of the fact that she has to bear that responsibility.
Is America a welcoming place, Julia, to people like Dalia in the time that you filmed? And how is that conveyed through the camera and through Dalia's eyes?
I don't know what to say about America, but Southern California is a particularly, I think, a particularly type of welcoming environment because there's so many immigrants here. And in Dalia's school, really, she was surrounded by young women from many parts of the world, you know, from Mexico, from Central America, from Korea, from the Philippines. And so in some ways, I think being in a crowd of girls whose families all came from somewhere else has a particular type of welcome.
Does that mean that if you step outside of that crowd, that in this Trump America, you need to fear?
I mean, I think that the anticipation is, if you understand what I'm saying, is a certain type of fear. You know, the scene that was shot right around when candidate Trump announced the travel ban came after the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. And I think for many Muslims in that moment, whether you're from Southern California or you're from the middle of the country, your anticipation is that people are going to be angry at you.
Mustafa, do you share that a certain kind of rhetoric is excused because of a high-profile terrorist attack and that you just sort of wait it out?
I mean, I think, like Julia said, we live in Southern California, so it's much more welcoming here. At the same time, we obviously live in a very, very connected time where, you know, just if you go on our comments sometimes on different projects that I've worked on in the past, including this one, you find people from different places that are extremely hateful. And so it is definitely something that you have to be much more aware of, I think, than previous times when you were just in your little bubble wherever you lived. And it's definitely something whenever a terrorist attack happens, many Muslims feel like, oh no, like, are we going to face a backlash for this? What is it going to be like? And you just have to kind of like be on edge for a while until, like, you know, things also people like forget about it for a while.
One of the things that surprised me in this film was that for Dalia, piety and being a pious Muslim is about supporting her family's decision to leave home. But that piety sometimes to another America looks like an embrace of a rejection of American values. And that conflict is really what this film is about. Do you think piety is forced to play two roles here, keeping our traditions, but also increasing the possibility that people are going to be misunderstood as radicals?
I wish that we didn't have that binary. I mean, I certainly feel that, I don't know, I think in our community here, it doesn't look like that. But maybe outside of Southern California, it might. But I can say that, you know, for Dalia, her faith and her identity as a young Muslim woman has been something that has rooted her and has supported her becoming who she is as a young Syrian American woman.
Julia Meltzer is director of Dahlia's Other Country, and Mustafa Ranizino is a co-producer of the film and Dahlia's older brother. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One of the things we've been loosely exploring this hour is how right and wrong and scientific truth exist in a philosophical framework. There's a fascinating new book on one of the giants of exact natural science, Isaac Newton. And it shows that as a man of his times, he was seeking ways that to us might seem silly to reconcile science with biblical prophecy. The laws of gravity and motion for Newton were part of an understanding of the universe, but facts that were as valid as the existence of God, a fact for Newton. The seemingly outlandish predictions of scripture like the end of the world, predictions in the Bible's Book of Revelation, all facts, again, for Newton. And for Newton, rational scientific thinking was a way of working out puzzles in the Bible, not for arguing against it. Newton, the religious thinker, is the focus of a new biography that tries to show that Newton, the founder of modern physics, was also a man of his turbulent times, a bridge between scripture and God. Today, you might know that Newton's philosophical chair is occupied by a fellow who speaks with a machine voice from a wheelchair who believes that black holes are apocalypses. That's right, Stephen Hawking says that God is irrelevant, but we need to be prepared to leave our planet because of climate change and worry about hostile aliens. Newton, the religious thinker, in a very different time, had a very similar mix of provocative views. Robert Iliff is professor of history and science at the University of Oxford, and he's author of Priest of Nature, The Religious Worlds of Isaac Newton. And it was a very religious world, Iliff says.
Well, he was brought up in a religious environment during the English Civil Wars. And he suffered. His father died before he was born. He was a lonely boy. His mother left him to some extent when he was 2 years old. But he's brought up in a religious framework. So he sees himself as specially chosen by God. He has this immense intellect, and he knows he has. And he has a duty to understand the natural world that God has created, and he throws himself into that. It's important to realize that he did nearly all his innovative scholarly research into the Bible and religion in the first two or three decades of his career. And after that, the last two or three decades of his life, the stuff is, frankly, much more tedious.
And yet the tools that were available for him at the time to understand these elements of the natural world were limited. His motions of the planets research is something that he is able to calculate from observational data that is available. And yet, as you say, this tedious last couple of decades of his life's work is mostly in the realm of alchemy. It's as though Newton has this sense that there is a world beyond what we know in mathematics, physics, and then chemistry.
Yeah, he actually did nearly all his alchemical research earlier in his career. And so this is searching for things that ordinary chemistry wouldn't give you. So, you know, the chemical basis of life, what he called active principles, things that what he calls vulgar chemistry wouldn't give him. And then I think when he moved to London in 1696, he became warden of the Royal Mint for the last 3 decades of his life. He largely gave up alchemy, but the questions that he was working on still remained. You know, what's the basis of life? Is it electricity? What are the major forces that underpin natural phenomena? I think the difficulty for those of us who work on Newton's religion and alchemy is there doesn't seem to be much connection between them. And I think we've kind of given up trying to force connections and concentrated on things like his work on the apocalypse, on church history, which is what he devoted 70 years of his life to.
Why wasn't the religious sort of elements of Newton's life in conflict with the scientific understanding of the laws of motion, for instance?
I think that Newton himself sees his researches into religion as very much of a piece with his work on science. You know, he believes that there are two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture, both created by God. And the more one understands about the order of nature, the more one in that period at least believes that it has to have been created by God. The order could not have arisen by chance. And then there's another issue, I think, which is that the vast majority of his writings, because they are so radical and formally heretical, they weren't known until long after he died.
What has become available that really enabled the research into this book, which has been years in the making?
Well, his papers really only became available in the early 1970s. After a long rerouting, they arrived in Jerusalem at the end of the 1960s. And it was only really in the last 15 years that many of us began to put his writings online, and they're now freely available online via the Newton Project. There's about 5 million words of his writings on the apocalypse, early church history, and so on. And I think it's only once all of those things were online that one could write the kind of book that I've done.
On the question of the apocalypse, which is something he devotes an enormous amount of energy to, I would think that as a science historian and someone who's got access to all these papers, that it might be a little nerve-wracking to investigate the apocalypse because, Newton has a habit of being right about things, And you could sort of stumble around, oh my gosh, it's next Thursday.
Yeah. Well, I hope he's not right about the apocalypse because that means the world's going to end in about 40 years. But it did take me a while to come to terms with the technical difficulties of his account of the apocalypse because it's tricky, it's difficult. He tries to go into it in more detail than anyone else before him because that's what he does. He has that kind of self-confidence and arrogance. But it is something that coloured his life. I mean, he is a Christian of a sort, and he believed that Christian writings, Judeo-Christian writings perhaps, were there for intelligent people to uncover the meaning of, if you like.
Intelligent people who might wanted to have gathered at a dinner with Isaac Newton would probably not have had a good time based on previous biographies and confirmed, it seems, by some of your work.
Well, I think even his friends called him suspicious, and that means paranoid, and clearly he was. But it's funny, his enemies tended to depict him in terrible terms as a sort of sociopath, and I think there's an element of that to him. But his allies and disciples and relatives all painted him in the most glowing terms. And, one or two of them actually said that he laughed once or twice during his life. So,
Oh my God. That's priceless. That is priceless.
I think one of the things about him is he is a Puritan in terms of his moral demeanor. And I think if people spoke slightingly about religion in any way, then he conceived a great dislike of them. So as long as you spoke respectfully about religion, I think he'd be an interesting dinner companion.
Robert Iliff is a professor of history of science at the University of Oxford and author of Priest of Nature, The Religious Worlds of Isaac Newton. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Laughed once or twice during his life. How many of us can say that?
Oh boy.
We've been talking this week about whether it makes sense to allow school staff to carry guns. It's a conversation you're all invited to join. Would it make you feel safer if teachers were armed and trained to take on active shooters?
This is Miles from Salt Lake City, Utah. The school I work at, we had active shooter training as part of our quarterly professional development training. And just knowing what I can do to defend my students gives me more confidence. And I don't think that necessarily having guns in the classroom is an answer, but I think that all educators should be trained for an active shooter situation.
My name is Kristen Dwelly, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. And as a white mother raising two black children, I would guess that most of the mothers who support arms in the school are not mothers who have black boys and thus are not aware of the differential use of force based on both race and gender. I myself am a school teacher and really oppose increasing weapons in any school district.
Let's keep this conversation going. You are invited, all of you out there. Give us a call with your views. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE or get in touch by Facebook and Twitter. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI.
and Staples. Staples offers copy and print services for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.